Welcome to the Tipsy Archives. I'm Rachel Ligge.
And I'm Erin Redicup.
And today we have some interesting ideas to talk about. So because we are going to be talking about some ideas around local history, heritage, and Indigenous identities, I want to start by saying that we are living, working, and podcasting on the unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. So I think the idea for this show came up because of the show that's on right now at the Museum of Vancouver. So why don't you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, so the show that is currently on at the Museum of Vancouver, well, it's been on for the whole summer, and it was recently extended to December 3rd, is Unbelievable. It's titled Unbelievable, and it's Secret, Rare, and Amazing Artifacts from the Vaults of the Museum of Vancouver. It's a neat exhibition. We'll be going into a little bit more depth about it, but it sort of came about with where the world is right now, with a lot of fake news coming out of the States and Donald Trump tweets, and the realization that we need to look at where you're getting your stories from, look at where you're getting your history from, and so the museum has created this show.
I think in combination with the fact that it was Canada's 150 this summer.
Yeah.
So, there's been a lot of, national stories, national pride, Canadian attention mm-hmm. to, things like our local history. So, I mean, that kind of worked well with the fact that that was happening at the same time, because it's a lot of local Vancouver history or objects and artifacts from our town's history.
Exactly. Like, every single object except for one comes from the collection, the Museum of Vancouver's collection. And that in and of itself is a really interesting thing to talk about, which we will talk about a little bit later in the podcast.
So with the Unbelievable show, I mean, there's all kinds of things. There's, outfits and furniture and lots of photographs. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the objects are, they have either an interesting story or a bit of a weird background or, just something about them that kind of makes you think.
Yeah.
And I think that's the kind of the point where everyone goes, oh, we've all heard about, for example, the girl in the wetsuit statue, which there's a replica of in the show. But, do you know the backstory and how that happened and what the legal issues were having to do with that?
Yeah, and why Vancouver has one and why it is a girl in a wetsuit, not a mermaid, which I always thought it was when I was a kid.
I know, I do too. I feel like I had that memory as a child, like in my little kid memory, it was a mermaid.
Yeah.
And maybe that's just kind of how I saw it.
I think so.
Like it wasn't, and then I even when I was an adult, I thought, oh, it used to be a mermaid and then they changed it.
Same.
But no, it's always been a girl in a wetsuit.
Yeah.
She's just kind of has her, I mean, she is supposed to be similar to the Little Mermaid statue in Copenhagen.
Yeah.
But they can't, of course, do the exact same thing because that's a copyright issue.
Yeah.
So she's sitting in a very similar position with her sort of swimming flippers looking kind of like a tail.
Yeah.
So it's sort of a play on it without actually being a mermaid.
Yeah. And the only time you really, really notice that she's a girl in a wetsuit rather than a mermaid is the fact that she's got the snorkeling goggles on as well.
Yeah, on her head.
And you do notice it a lot more when you're seeing the one in the show, because the one in Stanley Park is
quite far away.
And mm-hmm. so when you're actually going right up to the girl in a wetsuit, you can really tell.
I think that whole idea of examining fake news is very interesting. And the show asks some questions along the lines of, do people, whether it's individuals, governments, organizations, not include details or facts about stories when it doesn't fit into the narrative that they want to tell
mm-hmm.
or whatever it is that they're trying to sell. I mean, obviously the answer to that is yes.
Yes.
That does happen all the time.
That happens all the time. And also parts of the stories get forgotten too. And so sometimes when you're telling a story, you have literally forgotten the middle of it. And so there's some not great motives to it, and then there's some less bad motives, but you really shouldn't be presenting a story or a history until you've done your research.
Well, I think I mean, that happens a lot when it comes to, I mean, this happens in all kinds of situations, but specifically we are talking a lot about local history. Mm-hmm. Certain things get downplayed while other things get sensationalized. And soon what you have is more like a myth or a legend.
Yeah.
About, you know, a murder that happened in the city or something like that.
Yeah.
Doing the research for this show and thinking about some of these ideas of, you know, what, how our stories portrayed and what gets left out made me think about something that we experienced last year.
Mm-hmm.
We podcasted about the murder of Janet Smith, a young girl in Vancouver. And a very big part of that sensational murder trial was the fact that it was a cover-up. Police were involved. And at one point, they tried to pin it on the Chinese man who worked in the home.
Yeah.
And in the 1920s and 30s in Vancouver, there was a ton of racial tension in Vancouver with the Chinese community. Mm-hmm. So this was a very integral part of this whole story.
Mm-hmm.
We later went on a haunted tour of Vancouver, and they were telling this story because it's, you know, haunted story of a murder in Vancouver. It's a good story. And they said, they're driving, you know, around in this haunted tour. We go by the house where it happened. And they go, this is where she was murdered. And then they tried to pin it on the butler. And then she just moved on with the story. And they left out that whole section.
Yeah, and the fact that he wasn't a butler.
He wasn't a butler. They didn't mention him being Chinese. They did not mention him being kidnapped and tortured by the KKK.
Yeah, and
which happened.
And the fact that the police were kind of involved with them because they had a high-ranking member in the KKK.
And so I completely understand why on a quick ghost tour you wouldn't go into those details, but at the same time, here's a new reproduction of the story that's been extremely, you know, repackaged.
Yeah.
And kind of sanitized. Yeah, for people who may not have heard it.
And in no way was it a butler did it story when you know the full
extent
of it. And it the way that they said it too, it kind of made it seem like this like old British butler killed her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, not like the young, extremely poor Chinese houseboy who had very few employment options. And at the time, people were trying to pass laws to make it so that white women couldn't even work with Chinese people because they were considered inferior.
Exactly.
Like, it was... So, I mean, that just... It reminded me of that because, you know, I remember thinking, like, well, wait, that's not what happened, you know? Like, and... But because of circumstances of the tour or whoever organized it,
mm-hmm.
here's just one example of how details get left out and then carried on, and suddenly you have a very different history or a very different story that you're hearing than the one that is closer to the truth or is the truth.
Yeah. And it made me kind of wonder, like, in terms of that, what were the other stories? Like, what were the full stories of the other things we heard on that
tour?
Totally. And so it made me want to look into them more. I never did that, but mm-hmm. it made me really want to.
So, of course, I mean, we can't talk about things like stories and narratives, especially who's in the position of power. Like a museum
mm-hmm.
is in a position of power presenting a narrative about history and culture. And, of course, living where we do in British Columbia, Canada, our history is a colonial history.
Yeah.
And so, of course, when we talk about people whose stories have been brushed aside,
mm-hmm.
The Indigenous people of BC and Canada and America and all over the world, but specifically here, like we talked about or mentioned at the beginning, you know, the Musqueam people, the Squamish people. So you have colonial forces come on in and they do all kinds of things like rename entire areas, rename cities, rename mountains.
Yeah.
And then suddenly something that was, you know, rich in Musqueam heritage becomes... something that has British heritage or French heritage or something different.
Yeah.
In the show, in the Unbelievable show, they do talk about a really interesting woman who I would love to learn more about too, E. Pauline Johnson.
Yes.
So what can you tell me about her? Because that's going to bring me around to another story about rewriting history.
So E. Pauline Johnson, she is a fairly controversial figure in British Columbia history. She was half Mohawk, half British. Her father was Mohawk and her mother was British.
So is Mohawk Nation from the States or is it also in Canada?
It's also in Canada, but it's in the East.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So she was from Ontario.
Okay.
And then she eventually moved out here, worked a lot with the Capilano family.
Mm-hmm.
And then she's most famous for her writings, because she would write on Indigenous topics. She wrote a number of Indigenous novels, or not novels, Indigenous books. But one of the reasons why she's so controversial is she really tried to blend Mohawk and English culture together, because she felt she herself was unique, which she was.
Yeah.
And so she had a dress created for herself that's a traditional Mohawk dress. And it's in the Museum of Vancouver mm-hmm. show.
I mean, is the dress traditional or is it sort of something that she sort of also kind of blended and made interesting to present herself
yeah.
as this Indigenous woman to people, but almost in a...
sort of like a stylized version.
Yeah, she was stylizing herself
yeah.
and creating an image for herself. Because from the little I've learned about her, it kind of seems like she was trying to give a voice to a lot of Indigenous culture and stories. But she knew she had to market it towards, you know, basically white people or
yeah.
colonial people or the people in charge to get the attention. And to do that, she had to, you know, do it in a certain way.
Yes, and that's mm-hmm. exactly what that dress is, and that's why it's come to a lot of criticism, is it's not fully traditional. There were also concerns of, like, whether or not she herself should be wearing it, because she, you know, was not really fully raised as a Mohawk.
I've come across some interesting opinions in the art history, especially, like, museum studies and local history readings that I've done, where there is this sort of idea that when Indigenous people present themselves, it's supposed to be in this sort of quote-unquote authentic way,
mm-hmm.
where it should be pre-colonial and unchanged and not modern.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of the way that we want to see it.
Yeah.
And it's really cool to see some Indigenous artists now challenging that notion and saying, like, no, like, we're not a relic from the past. And, like, just, I just want to say, like, I have no Indigenous blood in me. I'm not speaking for anyone. These are just things I'm noticing and thinking, like, that's really cool.
Yeah. And I'm in the same boat. I have a very, very tiny amount of Indigenous blood, but not
I would
much.
Love if you are a First Nations person and you want to come on the podcast and talk about anything that you have to say about your culture and heritage, please come on. I would love to have that happen.
Yeah.
But just this whole idea about, like, pre-colonial authentic voice
mm-hmm.
that is, I think something that, I mean, I keep using the term, like, colonizers, but, like, it's complicated, right? Like, but you know what I'm saying, is the European people who came in and their descendants and et cetera, et cetera. But, like, they like the idea of that authentic view. But, you know, you look at what some artists are doing now. I mean, you look at, like, somebody like Susan Point, who's a Musqueam artist, who her stuff has a very traditional feel, but then sometimes she uses different kinds of color schemes or different kinds of, you know, materials, and it does have a more modern look to it, and it's gorgeous, and it's sort yeah. of blending this older tradition with something that looks newer and is exciting and really beautiful.
Well, and actually, speaking of Susan Point is in that exhibition as well with the manhole covers
right.
in Vancouver.
Right, right.
And that is also because you're blending the brain and something spiritual and something mm-hmm. that Indigenous people really, because there mm-hmm. many Indigenous cultures are very in tune with nature. And
yeah, it really feels like Vancouver has been searching for ways to blend Indigenous sort of, like, voices and artwork into an urban setting.
Yeah.
Because obviously, like, we're a city now, we're a modern city, but how do we bring that back in things like having you know, a Musqueam artist like Susan Point designing manhole covers.
Yeah.
Or, you know, other things that you're going to see throughout the city, just to say, like, things that in a small way saying, like, hey, we're on Musqueam territory.
Well, and it's also, now you like, you see this, it's different, you might look up, like, mm-hmm. who is this manhole cover? Mm-hmm. Oh, and then you'll learn more. Like, not everybody's going to do mm-hmm. that, but it's a statement, and it's also both, like, an encouragement for people to learn more.
Right. So the whole, we're talking about, like, Pauline Johnson, or E. Pauline Johnson.
Yeah.
And just, like, how she was this interesting woman who, she worked with a lot of chiefs in the area to gain local stories and compile them into books and publish them.
Mm-hmm.
And through some of her work, we were actually talking about her in class recently, and she talks about how, so there's these mountains in Vancouver that if you're here, like, you've seen them. There are these very, they stick out. It's one mountain, but it has kind of a double-capped
mm-hmm.
bare dome. They're on the North Shore, and we call them the Two Lions.
Yeah.
And I've actually tattooed these mountains on probably at least five people.
Oh yeah, people love the
because
lions.
it's just a visual symbol of Vancouver.
It is, and it's one of those things that you can tell if it's a clear day too.
Yeah,
because can you see the lions is a question that mm-hmm. gets asked a lot in Vancouver.
But the mountains weren't always called the Two Lions or the Lions.
Mm-hmm.
They were called the Two Sisters,
yeah.
And this was a story that she learned from. I'm not exactly sure which band, but from I think like a.
Yeah, it was Joe Capilano, I believe. It was the Capilano family that had taught her the myth.
Oh, okay.
But, yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. But, you know, it's about these two sisters that went to their father and said, you know, we don't want to be warring with these people, mm-hmm. a different group, probably more north.
Yeah.
And they convinced their father to go to this group in peace and, like, make peace with this other First Nations group. And these women were then venerated for what they had done to bring peace to their people, and the gods turned them into these mountains so that they would be there forever as, like, the symbol of peace.
Oh, I like that.
But then people come along, they make Vancouver, they yeah. start changing it, they start modernizing it. You know, there's a lot of things that are getting British names, the Queen Charlotte Islands, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So they decide to name these mountains, rename them, rebrand them, the Lions, because... Yeah. There's lots of lions in London and in British, you know, culture. Like, so they think these ones specifically were sort of speaking to the ones in Trafalgar Square, is
yeah.
what I've heard.
The ones that are around
there's a big, huge pole with a dude
yeah,
on top. I don't remember
yeah.
who that dude is right now.
Oh, it's Nelson.
Okay, it's yeah. Nelson. And then, of course, and then we have more lion imagery in Vancouver, the Lionsgate Bridge.
Yeah, well, lions are everywhere.
Yeah.
Because the Lionsgate is, you know, the gateway to the lions, but mm-hmm. it was property development. That's a different story, though.
Yeah.
And there's the lions that are in front of that. There's the lions on the Vancouver Art Gallery. There's lions everywhere here.
Yeah, and I think, like, that story just kind of reminds me of how the importance of naming.
Yeah.
Which I know in lots of cultures that relied on oral traditions, names are a thing of power. So you come in and you change something's name. Or even if you're not changing a name, if you're just giving something a name, you know, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
In history, that's what's going to be called. That's what's going to get passed down. That's, you know, these are things that add to this local heritage.
Well, and you never get to hear the previous story anymore, mm-hmm. right? Because mm-hmm. people aren't like, oh, like, now people are like, what are those lions? Or what are those mountains called mm-hmm. if they mm-hmm. come to Vancouver? And it's like, oh, they're the lions. And so you hear the interest in the lions. Nobody talks about how they used to be this, like, indigenous myth.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. so that story doesn't get passed down anymore.
Well, I just told it to you.
You did, so we'll just keep passing it on. You know,
I told it to someone at work today.
Well, hey, between the two of us, we will change everybody's perceptions. So, everybody will know it
but
now.
But now, like, the thing is, like, I don't know the sister's name. I don't know the specific band of people who it was. So, like, I have some bare information about it, but I need to dig further to get, like,
yeah.
The real actual facts about it. So that's, I'm only really at the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
So.
Exactly. They, interestingly, in Alberta, there's three mountains called the Three Sisters, and so I wonder if it's a similar story.
Hmm. Also, I mean, there's places in BC that are being renamed back to their original indigenous names, like Haida Gwaii.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, an interesting thing with that, and I was talking to somebody recently, and... like, I really want to go to Haida Gwaii, and I was explaining where Haida Gwaii was, and they still couldn't figure it out. Like, they could not place it. Mm-hmm. Like, it used to be the Queen Charlotte Islands. They're like, oh, I know exactly where that is.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting that some people don't make the link.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I actually had heard of both places for a long time and didn't realize that one was, Haida Gwaii was the Queen Charlotte Islands.
Yeah.
I didn't put that together until somewhat recently as well.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's interesting. I probably didn't until I started working in art, because that's where a lot of Emily Carr's paintings are done, is up in Haida Gwaii.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
So what else can we talk about that kind of came out of the show? I know one thing that you and I have talked about quite a bit and has come up is the idea, well, sort of like cities market themselves.
Yes.
And especially, you know, tourism. Tourism is huge in Vancouver.
Yeah.
Something that comes up in the show and comes up in many other places in Vancouver is the idea of marketing totem poles.
Yes. And totem poles are not local to this area.
No, totem poles are typical of more northern BC, like Haida.
Yeah, it's a big thing in Haida.
But, you know, you go to Stanley Park, you see totem poles in the park, you see totem poles behind the Museum of Anthropology mm-hmm. at UBC. And these are a thing that I think a lot of larger, or like British Columbian cities, they're like, oh yeah, we're West Coast, like, we have those too. But the truth is, totem poles were not here until people went and brought them here.
Yeah, exactly.
From up north.
Yeah.
So the one that's in the show, I mean, what you guys have is a house post?
Yeah, it's a house post. So it is not actually a totem pole. It's a similar style to a totem pole, but it is literally a post in a house. I can't remember for the life of me right now what the name of those houses are.
Like a longhouse?
Longhouse, yeah. And
So they did in this area have house posts. That was a common thing.
Yes.
But the totem poles you think of, especially the ones with kind of the wings at the top and...
Well, this house post has the wings at the top, too.
I guess I'm thinking of the totem poles are more of a standalone figure.
And it's not a standalone mm-hmm. thing. It's different. And, I mean, they're meant to tell stories. That's... There are many things that totem poles and house posts represent. One of them is stories. Mm-hmm. And that actually...
Things like family crests or birth and death and marriage and events and things like that are also memorialized in totem poles.
Exactly.
Or house posts.
House posts, yeah.
Yeah.
And so in 1927, house posts started to be raised in Stanley Park. And it was because they were going to create an Indigenous village in Stanley Park. And then it was never built. There were some protests about it, so it was never built. And so we actually, the Museum of Vancouver has the original house post that was in Stanley Park. The one that's currently in Stanley Park is a replica.
But the one that's at the museum now is laying down, right, because it's... I'm assuming this is because it's old and it's not good for it to be standing all the way up.
Yeah. It's a number of reasons. It was mm-hmm. partially so that it's easier for people to view mm-hmm. The house post. And then also because of its age, and it was outside at one point, you know, wood does rot and...
I have heard, I mean, I'm sure this is different from, band to band or group to group, that for many groups, totem poles are meant to fall apart in the weather. That's sort of like they build them, they paint them, they put them outside to mark whatever occasion it's for. Mm-hmm. And then they're meant to kind of, you know, be subjected to rain and wind, and they're supposed to fall apart.
Yeah, it's sort of a representation of the circle of life.
Yeah, exactly.
Ways. Yeah.
So, I mean, and now, like, we take things like that, we put them in museums and preserve them.
Yeah.
For reasons of teaching younger generations history, mm-hmm. but that's not really what the original intention was for some of these items.
Yeah, and to be honest, I am only learning these things now, mm-hmm. and my mom has, like, studied a lot of Haida art. I've worked in museums and art galleries for 8 years now, mm-hmm. and... I'm only learning them now. Mm-hmm. So it's not surprising that a lot of people don't know.
Well, and I think a big part of that, from what I've been learning, is that there is... organizations are trying to give more agency and more voice to the Indigenous artists and communities. So we are actually learning these things now, as opposed to just kind of taking them and deciding what we want to do with them.
Yeah.
Instead of being like, oh, shoot, this is ceremonial. Okay, let's learn about how it should be treated. Should it be put out? How should it be displayed?
Mm-hmm.
What's the purpose of it? And I'm not saying that history and that that anthropology wasn't there before,
mm-hmm.
but I think from my point of view, it seems as though there's been more agency towards First Nations people, and obviously, like, we have a long way to go,
mm-hmm.
but baby steps seem to be happening. I'm hopeful.
I'm hopeful, too, and I know one of the really neat things that the Museum of Vancouver is doing is...
A lot of work to do still.
There's so much work to do, but you've got to sort of celebrate every step. And the museum is bringing in Indigenous curators whenever there is an Indigenous artifact or an Indigenous show,
mm-hmm.
because it doesn't want to be this show of, like, white people telling Indigenous history.
Yeah, and exactly.
So there's a permanent Indigenous curator at the museum now. She played a huge role in that exhibition. So she's the one that tells all the stories about the house posts.
Mm-hmm.
And then for upcoming exhibitions, whenever there is an Indigenous focus, there'll be an Indigenous curator.
That's great. And as it should be.
Yeah, it's really important to do that. And
that's all part of the asking the right questions about whose story this is,
yes.
and what's the history, and how do we present it? Like, this whole, like, which is, you know, what the show is saying. I think, like, the biggest thing for me, like, going through the show afterwards was just, like, question everything.
Yeah.
Like, question where it's coming from, or is it true, or what did you think you knew about this thing?
Yeah.
So.
And...
which, for a curious person like me, is great.
It's really great. For me, it was really interesting because I'm not from Vancouver. I'm not even from British Columbia. And so there are all of these very local history things that are iconic to so many people who live here. Not just Indigenous artifacts, but, like, there's the R from the Ridge sign. I don't know anything
about the Ridge. I don't know anything about that either, because I didn't grow up here, and I'm not... that old.
Yeah. So. Well, I mean, the Ridge only closed in... I was taking a couple of my friends through the exhibition, and we were looking
at... And that was a theater?
Yeah, it was a theater here. Yeah. And it only closed in, like, the 2000s.
Yeah, I moved here in 2012, so...
Yeah, I moved here in 2010. So both of us... I think I was here when it closed, but I was too new to really care. But everybody else... Like, if you're from Vancouver, especially, like, Vancouver proper... you know about the Ridge Theater.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
One thing I'd like to talk about a little bit that is represented in the show is, we talked a little bit about how cities market themselves, especially to tourists, and
yes.
things like that. So when you have a big event happen to a city like the Olympics,
mm-hmm.
that is a huge marketing campaign for the city of Vancouver. You're presenting your image to the entire world.
Yes.
So, of course, a city's going to want to make themselves look good. They're going to want to put forth their best qualities. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, you're going on a date.
Yeah.
Or something. You're like, I want to talk about all of my achievements, but I don't want them to know about all my fucked up issues.
Yeah, you're not going to be like, so I actually failed the third grade.
Yeah. I actually have a huge problem with homelessness and drug addiction. So let's not talk about that too much. So while Vancouver was trying to, you know, present its best self to the world, a lot of people were kind of pissed off about certain things that weren't being represented, and the fact that the city was putting so much money into building things for the Olympics and sprucing itself up, while at the same time we had all this, you know, problem with, like I said, homelessness, the downtown east side, you know, lots of drug problems. I mean, many other problems that the city has.
Mm-hmm.
And one way in which they kind of protested that in a way that I thought was interesting and kind of cheeky was was through the mascots, was kind of subverting the cute mascots that the Olympics had designed and put together.
Yeah. And so... most of you are probably familiar with Quatchy, who was the sort of like Sasquatch type.
Adorable, furry, plushy Sasquatch with like a scarf and some earmuffs.
Cute. And mittens. He had the famous red mittens.
Okay.
He was very adorable. And so to protest that, they created the protest mascot, whose name is Squatchy. And he's a very skinny mascot. He's all
scraggly,
sewn together. And it's sort of meant to represent the real side of Vancouver, the Vancouver side that's being covered up by this new posh image that was created for the Olympics.
Yeah, so they you know, they took a symbol of something that was supposed to be cute and fun, and they flipped it.
Yeah.
To represent their issues.
And, like, Quatchy, or not Quatchy, Squatchy is really creepy.
Yeah,
Quatchy mascot.
I mean, it looks like Quatchy's the good one, right?
Quatchy's the one from the Olympics.
Quatchy is the cute one. Squatchy is the homeless one.
Yeah.
It looks like Quatchy got a drug problem and became homeless.
Yeah, so
basically,
it kind of represents what people thought Vancouver was covering up.
Yeah, so, I mean, there are both of these mascots in the show, so you can compare them side by side. But yeah, I mean, like, I always talk about things like, I'm from Kelowna. I always joke around about how Kelowna is this beautiful city with, a nice art scene and beautiful vineyards and this kind of, like, upper middle class, like, shiny veneer on top with, like, this really seedy underbelly that you don't really see if you don't live there, that involves, like, drugs and bikers and just, like, all kinds of... So, like, cities have complex identities.
Yes.
Some more than others. Some youth cities you think of and you think, oh, that's a scary place. But, like, some, like, Vancouver or even Kelowna, like, you think, oh, that's so nice. But, like, there's always a lot more going on there.
Yeah. It's not Baltimore, but...
No. But Baltimore is such a good setting for, like, shows and movies.
Yes.
Like Step Up 1 and 2. Or The Wire, you know. That's probably...
Yeah, The Wire is probably the one that makes sense. But, I mean, it is Step Up.
Mm-hmm.
So, we've talked a lot about what was in the exhibition. Well, some of the things that were in the exhibition and themes surrounding it.
But there's lots of other things. We're not going to sit here and list them. But, like, if you go see it, there's lots of really interesting little... pieces of history
until December 3rd. So Rachel, what was your favorite piece that you saw?
Well, we already kind of talked about the girl in the wetsuit, which wasn't necessarily my favorite, but there was a bit of a childhood nostalgia to that one, just because I remember walking the seawall with my grandparents when I was young. I did find there is a smallpox, like a First Nations carved smallpox mask that is really interesting looking, because I've never seen anything like it, and I've seen a lot of different kinds of masks, you know, Haida, Squamish, Gixxen, like, all different kinds of First Nations style of art and masks I've seen in different galleries, but this, I've never seen anything quite like this one, and it has these big lumps all over it, carved in wood, and it really kind of is obviously quite morbid and sad.
Yeah.
And it, like, makes you think right away about the terrible history attached to so many First Nations people being wiped out.
Yeah.
And the sickness. And, yeah, I mean, that one is really just quite striking. That one really stuck with me. That's the one I probably remember the most.
I agree with that. That one is very, very, like, it really hits you with the... what it represents, and I was talking to...
And that's them recording their own history in that moment.
Yeah.
Well, you know, whether it was written or an oral tradition, or, like, that was somebody saying, like, I need to record what's happening around me by making this mask.
Yeah, and it's gruesome. It's terrifying.
Yeah.
It's wiped out, like, nearly entire villages.
Yeah.
It's awful. It's haunting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really, really neat piece.
Yeah. In a really sad and terrible way, but it's, like I said, it sticks with you.
It really does.
Yeah.
It really does. For me, my favorite, well, one thing for sure, I love the design of the exhibition. It was done by HCMA Architecture and Design, and it's a lot of mirrors, so you can see sort of fuzzy reflections of yourself looking at the artifacts. And so I love the way that they did that design, because it's meant to represent you as part of the story, right, and how you are now part of, like, telling the story. You are part of the object in different ways. And so I love the design. And secondly, I think my favorite is the bicycle, because I've recently become very obsessed with bicycles. But it's really neat, because it also tells the story of how the Granville Bridge was, like, you used to be able to cycle across the Granville Street Bridge. It was, you know, a nice bridge for everybody. And then they were going to develop the superhighway that was going to go through downtown Vancouver. So the Granville Bridge was created. And then the superhighway was never actually created. So now you have this, like, ginormous bridge that is way larger than it needs to be, that is really only for cars.
Right.
And so it's not meant for cyclists, not meant for pedestrians. It's only meant for cars. And so how something like that changes the way a city develops and who uses it.
So we didn't even talk about, we talked a lot about representation and narratives and stories and legends and things like that, but we didn't even, you know, talk too much about how the infrastructure of a city, how a building, how a road, how that can change the way a neighborhood functions.
Exactly.
And things like that. I mean, it's all kind of part of the ever-changing identity of a city.
Yeah. But yeah, the Granville Street Bridge is terrifying, and I'm not a fan. And so I think I really like that story, because I'm really into...
It's something that affects you.
Exactly. It affects me, and I'm really into how mobility in the city affects communities and affects emotional well-being and physical well-being. But that's a really interesting concept. And it actually, it sort of means that, like, everybody has their own story of Vancouver, too, Vancouver represents.
That's totally what I'm saying. Like,
yeah.
The story of, like, I lived in the interior and I moved here 5 years ago is a lot different than somebody who immigrated here from China as a baby, or somebody who was actually born here, which seems rare. But people were born here.
I know. My husband was born here. It's weird.
Yeah.
Well, and for me, too, like, I've got my I came from the prairies, which is like every fifth person in Vancouver is I came from Alberta because it's cold.
It's a beautiful city. It can be expensive.
Yeah.
But we love it.
We love it. We're never going to own property.
Nope. But yeah, I mean, Vancouver has a lot of interesting stories. It has a very complex history, a very multicultural history. You know, like we said before, we are on unceded territory here. But, you know, there's a long, long way to go to making amends to some of the things that have happened in Canada with the First Nations people. But, you know, start in your community by recognizing where you live.
Yeah.
And who used to live there and what kind of artwork is around you and what those traditions look like. That's one thing that you can do. You know, look into the area you live in. Maybe this isn't interesting to a lot of people, but it's really interesting to me.
It's fascinating to me. Things aren't always what they seem, and you need to sort of dive deeper.
Well, and I think I'll just end by sort of saying, like, anytime you go, I mean, this was the purpose of the show, to kind of, like, get you to ask questions. But anytime you go to a show in an art gallery or museum or something like that, you know, it's still good to ask yourself those questions. Like, who is presenting this show? Whose narrative is this? You know, why did they put this painting up? Who is the artist? Like, if you just, like, ask yourself a few questions about how these things have been set up and presented, you might find, like, something way more interesting.
Well, and even another important thing to look at is, like, who's sponsoring this exhibition?
Yep. Absolutely.
So, because some things are not said because somebody is sponsoring an exhibition.
There's always more going on.
Make sure you look into it.
Well, thank you so much for coming and telling me a bit more about the show that I have now seen, I think maybe only the one time.
I think you only saw it the one time.
But I should try to see it again before it's gone. And like you said, it's open till December 3rd. If you're at all interested in local history and just, like, really interesting facts about the city, I think there's probably something for everyone there.
There's definitely something for everybody.
Yeah.
And plus there's a neon gallery that's right beside it, which is super cool.
I love the neon gallery. It's just all these great old neon signs from Vancouver, and, like,
It's kind of like walking through, I was going to say a junkyard, but that doesn't sound right.
But it kind of is. Well, and in Vegas there is
That's what it reminds me of, like, yeah. That sort of, like, it's the, what is it, like, the, it's like the graveyard of neon signs sort of thing. It's cool.
I consider it the neon sign graveyard.
Yeah. Okay. I was like, I don't want to say something offensive, but.
No. When I'm having a bad day, I just go hang out in there for a little bit and just I feel better.
Hear the hum of the neon.
It's very peaceful if you don't have a headache.
Yeah. Cool. Well, we're going to end this off, but, like, I keep forgetting to do this.
Yes.
So I'll quickly say, when we went traveling, I kind of stopped putting the intros and outros because it just made it so much easier for me to post it quickly.
Yeah.
And I kind of stuck with that because, like I said, it's just kind of been easier and it's been flowing well. But I keep forgetting to tack on the email and stuff. So, of course, if you guys have listened to this and you enjoyed it, if you have any interesting stories about Vancouver, of course, we'd love to hear them.
Yeah.
If you have any interesting topics that you want to hear us talk about or even come on and talk about it with me or us, that would be awesome. So you can follow us on Twitter at Tipsy Archives, or you can email us at thetipsyarchives@gmail.com. And reach out to us and talk to us, please.
And we're on Facebook as well.
We are on Facebook as well.
Yeah.
Probably just search the Tipsy Archives. We'll come up.
You'll find us. And we're available on all of your different streaming services.
Oh, yeah. We're on iTunes. Yeah. Not every single podcast app, but most of the ones that I've looked at will come up on. Because we've got, I think, 26 episodes now.
Yeah.
And there will be more. We'll definitely do more local Vancouver stuff because I love that.
It's awesome. Local Vancouver is the best.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, thanks, Erin.
Cheers. Thank you.